God's help. Again, I pray to God that He should give me the wisdom. I should be able to impart the wisdom of God to this esteemed audience and to the media. It should carry far and wide, and it should be acceptable to all. And of course, again, I want to thank Ishmael and the Society for giving me the opportunity, the honor and the privilege to be here. Thank you, and assalamu alaikum again to all. We've basically covered in very concise form, really, the Zionism and Judaism, the differences, and thank God our speeches, although we came from different ends of the world, from different religions, and from all different angles, and we came to, I think almost we can say, to pinpoint the same exact speeches. Like somebody mentioned that we could actually change names, the rabbi, the politician, the other, and we would have been able to hold the speeches, because it boils down to the same thing. This is the Judaism is this religion, and there is no two ways of presenting this religion. It is very quite clear, and all the rabbinical authorities at the time of Zionism, the inception of Zionism, were in opposition as a basic whole. And Zionism came along as a political interest void of religion. And that is very, very clear, and we've all brought this point to light. I maybe we'll just add on one. We find, I've mentioned to Ishmael last night, that we had the writings of a German general in World War I. He wrote a book called Mit den Türken zum Suez Canal, with the Turks to the Suez Canal, and it was a write-up, a book review that I noticed in Haaretz, where they wrote that at the time, this is in World War I, so it was way before the creation of the State of Israel, and he writes, this one who was writing the book review says that it's interesting to note, to see how Palestine of 90 years ago appeared to this General Kress, who wrote this book. He said, a phenomenon that was extremely odd was how the war caused an unprecedented upsurge in the battle between Zionists and not Zionists, a battle that turned ugly and did little to promote Jewish interest in general. At the same time, the non-Zionists, that is the Jews without political goals, mainly belonged to the Orthodox stream. They were the overwhelming majority in Palestine, not the overwhelming majority, this is Ami adding, not the overwhelming majority of the inhabitants of Palestine, because that was the Muslims, there's no question about that. We're talking about the non-Zionists were the overwhelming majority of Jews living in Palestine. The Orthodox stream were the overwhelming majority in Palestine. The Zionists living in Palestine scarcely made up 5% of the population, but they were very active and fanatical and terrorized the non-Zionists. During the war, the latter tried to free themselves, that is, the non-Zionists tried to free themselves from the terror with the help of the Turks. They feared justifiably that the activities of the Zionists would ruin the good relations that existed between the long-time Jewish inhabitants of Palestine and the Arabs, and the Turks also might adopt hardline policy that would harm them too, and so forth. I mean, this was just to show how the relationship, this was an impartial view by a German general who had nothing to do with either of the societies, how the Jews lived then. Then afterwards we had Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, of blessed memory, the first chief rabbi, who wrote to King Hussein, who wrote, gave her a letter showing the loyalty of the Jewish community. We spoke about Rabbi Dushinsky, of blessed memory, in 1947, sent a letter it was in the dockets of the United Nations. He said, I have 60,000 inhabitants under me in Jerusalem, and we do not want to be included in the State of Israel, in the Jewish state that is being created. Just I'll quote it. He says, the Jewish Orthodox community of Jerusalem comprising 60,000 souls objects to the freedom of including Jerusalem in the Jewish state and or its residents becoming automatically citizens of the Jewish state. Our community demands that Jerusalem be an international zone. He was speaking about his people. There was no issue of a Palestine. So he demanded that he didn't want to be under the Jewish state. Now, how ironic how the chief rabbi, the most Orthodox, didn't want to be included in a Jewish state. So, I mean, it's quite very clear that Judaism and Zionism is in total opposition. How the Jewish people live together in harmony throughout the Muslim world was also discussed, but I'll just mention here and there, just to say, for instance, you were mentioning Rabbi, the other speaker mentioned Rabbi Becher, and Rabbi Becher was a fellow, the professor, I'm serious, man who spoke about that, Rabbi Becher was one of the people who, after the first Aliyah that the Zionists took up Jewish people to the land of Israel, at that time Palestine, and they took up, by calming them and telling them that the Messiah is coming, and all different types of actions, the people of Yemen, they actually took them almost forcibly, and they died going up to Israel. They didn't have proper transportation. They died. It was merciless the way they took these Jewish people up. The Zionists took the Jewish people out of Yemen. Anyway, but then afterwards, the land of Yemen was closed because the Yemenite government at that time was very strongly anti-Zionist, and they closed the borders. And Jews couldn't go in because they developed this animosity between Zionists and between Jews automatically. They were mistrusted by the Arab population. So Jews couldn't go to Yemen. Now, as rabbinical authorities, Rabbi Becher at the time, this was many years ago, discovered that there is many Jews still remaining in the hills, in the back hills of Yemen, in Khaydan, in many Reda, in different areas. And he decided that he would like to go to these Jews and help them. These were Jews that were sort of stranded in a certain way. They didn't have the whole population to support. So he started going secretly, and I remember this. I remember from 25 years ago, that we kept it very quiet. We kept it undercover because we didn't want anybody to know that the Zionists shouldn't find out about these people, basically. We wanted to keep it under wraps. Anyway, we traveled there. And we got permission from the Yemenite government because we were able to prove to them that we are not Zionists. And the doors were open to us. We traveled every single year for it's over 30 years or 40 years. We would travel every single year. We'd send emissaries, rabbis. We had the best connections with the Yemenites, the government, the Jews, the non-Jews. Anyway, to make a long story short, the people of the Yemenite people lived next door, door to door, neighbors with the Jewish people on the best of terms. They were like brothers. But the Zionists kept on writing that, oh, it's terrible, you know, that the Muslim people you can't live with them and so forth. When I went there around 10 years ago, they wrote in the Israeli papers, they had started taking out Jewish people from Yemen again, because they opened the borders. And they started writing how they're forcibly converting the Jewish people in Yemen, the little bit that's playing, the few thousand people that are there, they're forcibly converting. They were not there. We were there. There was no such thing going on. It was like unbelievable. But they kept on writing this in the papers, and who would listen to us, even though we had pictures, we had everything. This was going on. And all of a sudden, 2 years ago or something, when they completed their mission of taking up all these Jews from Yemen, all of a sudden, in the Jerusalem Post, they wrote a story about a Jewish fellow who went back to Yemen. And it's just so interesting, being that they didn't have this mission to bring up the Jews because there was almost nobody left there in Yemen, all of a sudden they write this story, and I'm just going to quote a few sentences, it's so interesting. They write, a fellow returned to Yemen. He says, Ya Yichya, my brother, and exclaims Masud, he says, Ya Achi, that's an Arab. Yes, my brother, he said. Here is my mom. Masud emotionally pointed to the woman in the creased photograph. Masud is a Muslim from the Al-Nazir Abiyad tribe. He lives in Wadi Amla, an oasis in the remote desert region of northern Yemen, close to the Saudi border. The woman in the photograph is an unlikely mother to Masud, because her name is Kidyat Sabari, a Yemenite Jew who emigrated to Israel a few years ago. The brother that he's talking to, Ya'achi, his brother, is Yaakov Tzabari, her son, who went to Israel with the first group of immigrants in 1992. That was the second wave that they pulled up. Yaakov, sitting in the stand during a recent visit to his former home, explains that the family relationship that he calls him his brother with tears in his eyes. He said, Masud and I are the same age. When Masud was born, his mother did not have enough breast milk, so my mother nursed him as well. While the Arab-Israeli conflict rages elsewhere in the Middle East, the scene in the dunes and mountains of northern Yemen reveals something of the extraordinary coexistence that thrives between Jews, the settled tribesmen, and nomadic Bedouins here. They shared the mother's milk. This was the relationship. I have a story. Again, I'm not going to, because they asked us to, being that the time is late, I shouldn't have a long speech today, so we're just going to concise. We had in Hebron, it's constantly used by the Zionists as proof that there is an ingrained hate between Muslim people and Jewish people. The Hebron massacre, that is the famous Hebron massacre. Hebron massacre occurred in 1929, and we have a letter that was transcribed. It was a tape that Rabbi Baruch Kaplan, who was one of the esteemed rabbis, he started the girls' school movement in the United States. That's Jacob Girls' School, which is worldwide and very famous. We have separate boys' schools and girls' schools by Orthodox Jewry. And he started this movement. He was a student in Hebron in 1929. And on our site again, which is www.nkusa.org, you can find it, the transcribed letter. He speaks about, when he spoke to his grandchildren to give over his history and how they should live, he said, when I was in Hebron, I'm quoting, in 1929, there occurred the tragic massacre of over 20 yeshiva students, great scholars, plus another 40 members of the Jewish community. I would like to describe the error that has circulated in Jewish communities. A horrible error that accuses the Arabs in Hebron of being murderers who attacked the Jews simply because the Arabs were bad people. In order to correct the record, this error must be corrected. The Arabs were very friendly people, and the Jewish people in Hebron lived together with them and had very friendly relations with them. They worked for Jewish people as workers and so forth, and everybody got along just fine. To take just one example, I used to have the habit of walking a mile or two out of town all by myself to visit a tree that was believed to be the tree where the patriarch Abraham met the three angels as described in Genesis. I especially enjoyed visiting the tree in the summertime. Along the way, I would talk to the Arabs, though it was mostly using our hands because I didn't speak any Arabic. Interestingly enough, no one in the yeshiva ever told me it was dangerous to go by myself among the Arabs. We just lived with them and got along very well. I had seen a letter from the Grand Rabbi of the Gerach Hasidim. He wanted to find out what people were living in Palestine. I'm going to just leave out positive. He wrote in his letter that the Arabs were very friendly and fine people. So forth, so forth. Then afterwards he says, today's wicked Zionists are just like their predecessors, who were responsible for causing terrible suffering in Palestine with their wars with the Arabs. May God have mercy. At that time in 1929, the Zionists had a slogan arguing that the Western Wall in Jerusalem, the Al-Aqsa, in Jerusalem was a Jewish national symbol. And, of course, the Arabs disagreed with this idea, considering that they had control of the location for over 1,100 years. However, the Zionist mobs were yelling that, quote, the wall is ours. It is hard to understand why they felt that way, considering they had no connection to the Jewish holy places whatsoever. What did they need this wall? An argument erupted in the Jewish newspapers about establishing a permanent prayer area for Jews at the wall. This provoked the Arabs, and the rabbi of Jerusalem at the time, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld of blessed memory, begged them to stop and to be appreciative to the Arabs for allowing Jews to pray at the wall for so many centuries undisturbed. However, the Zionists wanted a permanent setup under the control. Again, I'm going to leave out that how they provoked the Arabs by their constant statements, and this began the conflict at the time between the Zionists and the Arabs. Afterwards, we were studying at the yeshiva in Hebron and saw a bunch of boys in short pants carrying weapons on bicycles and motorcycles running around the streets of Hebron. We were very worried about this. What were they up to? In brief, our rabbi, the supervisor of our religious academy, Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Epstein of blessed memory, called them for a meeting, but they refused. He was forced to go to these young students, to these young boys, and ask them what they were up to. He accused them of wanting to provoke the Arabs. They responded that they were coming to protect us. We cried out, woe is us, God have mercy. This is what the Jewish community had with the Zionists. He continues, they didn't want to leave the town until it was too late. These Oregon cowards only ran away when the local leaders of the Arabs called for a mass meeting of the people of the surrounding Arab villages. But it was too late. The Arabs got organized and the Mufti called out his people to be ready Friday night when the yeshiva would be attending prayer. At this point, the yeshivas were alone against the Zionists. The yeshiva students was alone. But the Arabs didn't know to distinguish between us and the Zionists. Sadly, they attacked and killed some of our people, including the great scholar, Rabbi Shmuel Rosenholz, of blessed memory. And again, he speaks about he was saved by the Arab owner of the house. He was saved. This is just to show you the falsification of history, what Zionism does. Even the Hebron, they have the nerve, the chutzpah, to speak constantly about how the Muslims have this ingrained hate, we can't live side by side. The fact is we did live side by side. Here we have an esteemed rabbi, and he lived to 120. He learned in Hebron. Rabbi Lezer Hochheiser lived and learned in Hebron in 1949, I believe it was, and he heard from the mouths of the students there about how they coexisted. His wife, his family, how they lived, they babysat each other's children, a living witness. We have this all over in our Jewish communities. For us, it's the simple ABC, we know this. And this is the way we've been living. Why do I have to harp on this? First of all, I plead with people, I request, I ask people wherever I go, Muslims and Jews, write down the history, record it if you can't write, email it to our site. This history should not be forgotten. We must know how we coexisted. I hear constantly stories of this. I could go on and on. In Iraq, there's somebody, Giladi, who made a book of Ben-Gurion scandals. I interviewed him personally. I said, how was your relations with the Muslims? He said, what do you mean? The Arab children would go up and kiss the rabbi's hand when they would pass, as respect. We would make sukkahs. That was our holiday sukkah. We would boot and on a certain time, and the Arabs would hang fruits and take it out after the holiday. They considered it blessed fruit. This was how we coexisted. So the fact is, we were able to live together in peace and harmony. Now we can't because of Zionism. This part of the panel, the discussion was supposed to be how the future will be, what could be done. We can't, of course, say what will happen. We are not prophets. We could say and do what God requires of us. The accomplishments have to be done by God, but we have an obligation to do, to sanctify God's name by revealing what's being done in His name is desecration and revealing the truth. And we've been taught that at times, even the times of the prophets, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, if somebody could help me with the English translation of the three prophets, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Somebody will eventually say it says that God wanted to turn over the world, and because it looks that the Jewish people were bowing to idol worship. They were forced at the time, but it looked like, and these three stood up and they said no. They are not going to, they stood up and they didn't bow, even though it wasn't really technically that the Jews were bowing, but it seemed that everybody agreed to bow to a person. And they stood up. Hananiah says in the books of Daniel. And they stood up, and they said they're not going to, and they were thrown into a fire in the time of Daniel. Excuse me? Oh, thank you. Yes, okay, and they were thrown into fire, and they were not burnt. The miracle happened, but it says God wanted to destroy the world because it looked like that everybody was serving idol worship. They didn't want to accept God, the God's kingdom, and they weren't ready to give their lives. These people stood up, and because of that, God saved the world. We have to do. God requires of us to go and speak out to the world, speak out the truth and sanctify His name, say what Judaism really is, that it's compassion, that it's against Zionism and it shouldn't be equated. And God will do the rest. And what is the solution? The solution we were speaking, that we are here constantly, one state. I have to clarify what this means, one state, that according to the Jewish, what one state means. One state means, again, the return as a Jew is required to be a loyal citizen. The Jewish people are required by God to be loyal citizens in every country where they reside. This is a very fast and strong commandment of God. This means that we have to be give back and return the self-rule to the Palestinian people, the indigenous south of the Palestinian. The Jews are also living in Palestinian, but I mean the Palestinian indigenous, the Arab rule to them, to the Arab people. And we give them the option of how they want to rule the land, whether it would be a democracy allowing Jewish people to have the rights there as a democratic vote, fine. If they want to have the voice that it should be under religious leadership, we have to accept that, and we do accept that. That is what we want, because that is what God wants. And any other way cannot be successful. You cannot fight God's hand. You can't shoot yourself, as I mentioned before, out of a spiritual happening. So to try to make even a one-state solution where you'll say, I'm going to dictate for the Arab people that I'm going to drop the state of Israel. It hasn't been successful anyway. As many people realize that it hasn't been successful, and they realize that in the future there's going to be, the Arabs are going to be anyway the majority, whatever. We have to make a one-state solution, and the Arabs will have to accept this. No, that is not the Jewish way. That is wrong. The Jewish way is to return the self-rule to the Palestinian people and to accept. We have to apologize profusely for what has been done to them and pay them back for the damage, for what's been done to them, and return the houses to them where it exists, return everything, and ask them if they would give us permission to coexist with them. And what the people, and what they let us to exist, we are very thankful. And if God forbid we have to leave and travel, we have to accept that. That is a godly command. And we accept it because we can't second guess God. And that is the only way that could be good, and it will help. Now, again, people all of a sudden, if you remember years ago, they said, no, this solution is the right way, and everybody says 100% this is the solution, and it hasn't been successful. And even though it looks so clear that it was. Today, they're coming with this one-state solution, whatever it is. I'm telling you again, I'm not a prophet. If you'll follow God, you will be successful. Even though it can make it look like it's written in cement, it's etched in stone, it will. We cannot be successful, even if it looks to you successful, because you can't second guess God. The solution is, as I say, returning the leadership, and then we can live together in peace. And it will be metaphysically, spiritually, God will. You will see, as just as you've seen in South Africa. That has been able to change, but here you will especially see, being that it is the will of God clearly that we should live together peacefully as we have, and as long as it's not as I said, they definitely will be able to live together, and there won't be a fear of living together. It will work out. And any other way, unfortunately, I mean, peace is very, which cannot happen. You can, and some people, you can take strength in looking at communism, how communism overnight disappeared. So you see that things can happen. Following God is just an example. God sometimes gives us examples. You can see that if you follow God, you can even see it with your own eyes that things could change overnight. We have to pray. As people who believe in God, we must all pray constantly for the speedy and peaceful dismantling of this rogue state, of the Zionist state. And God will help. We have to do our obligations, and God will bring about this peace and harmony that we could live together. And as examples show, I just bring the examples to show you, because truthfully we don't need examples. God's word is the word. But the examples show how we have lived together in peace. We can and we will, again, live together in peace. And then ultimately we pray, we have to pray for the ultimate revelation of God, when all humanity will recognize the one God and live together in peace. Amen. Thank you.
Rabbi White.